Welcome to Sound Philosophy, a podcast exploring philosophical and interpretive issues in the history of music and in the history of philosophy itself. In this episode, I'm joined once again by Eric Texier to discuss Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle, this time Book 3, Chapter 1. Thank you for joining us. Enjoy. Joined once again by Eric Texier. I suppose I don't have to say that each time because I'm always joined by Eric Texier when we're talking about Aristotle, which is what we're doing today. We're continuing with the Nicomachean Ethics, and we're approaching Book 3, which is a very special book in some ways because Book 3 has a kind of interesting organization. Eventually, Book 3 will pick up where Book 2 left off in its latter chapters. There are 12 chapters in Book 3. And so chapters 6 through 12 will go into sort of recapitulate certain aspects of chapter 7, I think, of book 2, where he's laid out the various virtues, and he's even laid out some things that are not quite virtues, like shame or whatever. And he's going to return to a discussion in more depth of the character virtues in the latter part of book 3. But before that, there's a kind of extended parenthesis, and it's a very important parenthesis. There are entire books that are written about the five chapters that we're going to start talking about today, chapters 1 through 5 of book 3. And there's a range of opinions as to what exactly is happening in these books. Don't get me wrong. People agree basically on the various topics that are covered. But what the exact purpose is of chapters 1 through 5 is a point of some contention, right? Yeah. Is it a theory of responsibility? Is it a theory of choice? Is it a theory of action more generally, right? Is it the most controversial, I suppose, would be Anthony Kenny suggesting that this is an argument about freedom and free will. Whether or not there is a modern notion of free will in Aristotle is a point of some debate. And of course, Anthony Kenny is at the center of that because he wrote an entire book about Aristotle's ideas about human will. In some ways, it deals with all of those things, right? It deals with the ability to do otherwise, which for someone like Kenny is a hallmark of free will, right? It deals with issues of choice, deliberation, wish, and how those things are related. It deals with the voluntary and the involuntary. It deals with praise and blame. And that's one of the things that I think is so interesting about what Aristotle's strategy is here. And so we're going to really take our time, I think, with these five chapters to get at some of what's going on. Because what Aristotle's doing is not easy, at least for me, to track at first. If I were to talk about the voluntary and the involuntary, I'm not sure that I would start with praise and blame. But when he does that, it becomes evident why he's doing that and how that's functioning, or at least I hope it becomes evident, or that I can help make it, that Eric and I can help make it evident. So I think I just laid it out, but I'll say it once again. The five chapters that open book 3, the first one deals with the voluntary and the involuntary. The second chapter deals with choice. The third with deliberation. The fourth with wish. And then 5 sort of summarizes the results and returns to the issue of the voluntary and the involuntary. And you can understand why he might want this at this point. In fact, actually, I think I'll turn it over to you, Eric, because I think you have more thoughts as to why it appears here than I do, that include my thoughts, but that you had some additional ones. So do you want to lay out some of what you were thinking as to why this appears when it does?
Well, I guess just to start, I think when we ask what are these chapters about, there's the obvious just sort of let's try to read the chapters and figure out what they're about. But there's also the issue of what motivates them, because it really is kind of a surprise. I think any reader getting to the end of the previous book will probably think, you know, all right, we got a sketch of character virtue. It's a state that aims at a mean. We've outlined what those mean states are. So let's just go into more detail about them, about those virtues. And then he seems to change the subject here. That's the sort of feeling. So then the basic question of what's this all about is the motivation behind it. And I'm not entirely sure. I don't think, I mean, we could read the very beginning of chapter one as trying to explain that. But I, for whatever reason, I feel like there's, you know, there might be a loose end that he's trying to cover. So you can tell me if you think I'm right or wrong, but here's the basic way that I see it. Earlier, Aristotle had mentioned that people become virtuous by doing virtuous things, right? It's a sort of learn by doing cycle. And in chapter four of the previous book, he was aware that there's a possible problem here, and he was responding to this charge of circularity, right? The idea that it's impossible to learn virtue by habituation because we have a sign of virtue already in virtuous action. So if you get the right action, that's already virtuous. There's no reason to say that we learn to be virtuous by doing virtuous things. But he's arguing at that point that virtuous action alone is not enough to call someone virtuous. The action needs to be done in the right way, or as the virtuous person would do it. So the question then is immediately, well, what does that mean, as the virtuous person would do it? The overall gist, I think, of what he's after when he says you need to do the right thing in the right way is that the source of virtue needs to be in the person, not in ultimately in abstract arguments, and not just sort of independently in the action itself. So generally then, he still needs to show how to connect outward signs of virtue back to the person. That's the sort of basic problem that he's kind of contending with. How do we connect the thing that we recognize as the action to the virtue, the character of the person? And he also actually helps to narrow that down a little bit more. When he wrote earlier that an action is typical of a virtuous character, it satisfies a few conditions, and there are two main ones for him. It's chosen for its own sake, and this is this idea of choice or decision, and it arises from the person's disposition or state. And of course, we spend a lot of time on that second one, right, on the state, the disposition. And he even reiterates that in chapter six of the previous book when he indicated that it's a state, right, that virtue is a state that involves decision or choice. So mm-hmm. That's something that he still needs to cover. Basically, there's this loose end that he needs to cover of decision. Yeah. So that's
which is why some people think of the main aspect of these five chapters being really choice. That chapter two is the linchpin here, right? Because you're right. He does say that virtue is this character state that involves choice, but he hasn't yet defined how choice works and so on. To some extent, the way you're presenting it, it almost seems like what he's trying to avoid is a kind of Forrest Gump situation, right? like I hate that movie, but and if people like it, I'm sorry, but no one should like it. But at any rate, let's say that you haven't seen Forrest Gump. Basically, the way that it works is this guy just happens into everything available to him, right? So it's the 70s or whatever, and the smiley face turns out to be his invention, the smiley face sticker, right? Mm-hmm. Even though he doesn't exactly invent it, but he inspires it.
All the iconic things are connected to
right,
him in some way.
Right, yeah. JFK at some point, right? Vietnam protests, that he's at the center of all of these things without ever intentionally doing it. Mm-hmm. And so we're supposed to get this idea that he's an innocent. And I think we're supposed to get the idea that he's an innocent almost in a sort of exaggerated theological sense. That he's not actually making any decisions, because that wouldn't be innocence. Decision involves a certain lack of innocence, right? Because when we're deciding, we're taking a step back and we're saying we can evaluate and we know. But a truly innocent, in this sense, a true innocent in the sort of theological sense, is one that brings to bear no knowledge. It's just purity of the expression of their purity, right? Mm-hmm. And I get the impression that that's part of what Zemeckis was up to with Forrest Gump, was he's trying to show this almost impossibly good person who's not consciously doing anything but does everything right and changes the entire world because of it. So this way in which this non-entity becomes a totalizing entity. And so you can imagine a situation, right, because we have it imagined for us in that film, of a person who is not really involved in choice in a direct way, at least not the kinds of choices that would amount to what happens in the film, right? That most of this is happenstance, but it's not just happenstance, right? It's not like you could substitute an evil Forrest Gump and the movie would work the same way, right? No, I'm being serious. Yeah. I guess it's goofy in a way, but I am being serious, right? Like in the logic of that movie, if you had an evil Forrest Gump, he had all these bad intentions, and yet almost like Faust, right? Like in when Mephistopheles says, "I am the spirit that wills good, that wills evil and yet does good," right? That's sort of Goethe's the playwright and poet that wrote Faust, of course. That's his sort of theological statement, that's his way of dealing with the problem of evil, right? That evil's not a problem because evil contributes to the good, which in some theological ways of thinking would be false, obviously false, right? But this is his way of dealing with the problem of evil. With Forrest Gump, you can't imagine Forrest Gump being a Mephistopheles character and that film still working the same way, because we're supposed to root for Forrest Gump. And even though me as a reader personally, I don't exactly root for Mephistopheles. I think we're supposed to be charmed by Mephistopheles in the same way that we're supposed to be charmed by Satan in Paradise Lost. Mm-hmm. But we don't root for Satan in Paradise Lost. We don't root for Mephistopheles in Faust, right? But we're supposed to root for Forrest Gump. But why? Why are we rooting for this person who I just described as a non-entity? And I know I'm probably pissing people off. The three people that happen to be listening to this that like Forrest Gump, one of which would be my mother. But, the idea here is that we have to root for Forrest Gump, but we're rooting for him because he's not like us. He's not making decisions. And so Aristotle's trying to avoid the idea of just looking at the external. Because if we're just looking at the external with Forrest Gump, and we're just looking at what happens, it would seem like he is, and this is what annoys me about the movie, probably the most important person that existed in that range of years, right? Because so many important things came out from him, trivial and important. Like this, the smiley face sticker in one sense is very trivial, in another not so much, right? I mean, it was a major icon of the 70s. I think it occurred in the 70s for a specific reason, because of the sort of social and cultural malaise of the 70s. And so you could see it as being incredibly important. But what Aristotle wants is all those things to be the result of choice, of decision, not happenstance.
Well, probably the most important thing for the people who like Forrest Gump, other than, you know, the
therapy.
The therapy's
the most important thing.
Yeah, well, wow, it was that bad, right? Well, other than maybe the fun music at the beginning, right, that is so memorable, we have also at the beginning to sort of hook us into Forrest Gump, because otherwise I totally agree there's something kind of empty and disappointing about it. But to make us sort of feel like it's all worth something or that it's all for something, it is because of a certain kind of choice that he makes, which is to devote himself to Jenny, right? He's sort of obsessed with Jenny and in love with Jenny, but in a, as you probably would point out, in a kind of pure of heart way, right? In some sort of theological way.
Yeah. And when did the choice happen? See, that's a good. See, maybe now I feel like we should have a special episode on Forrest Gump, but I'd have to rewatch it. I haven't seen it in decades. Yeah, I was forced to see it twice, and I really obviously don't. It stuck with me. I mean, just like American Beauty, like I hated that movie too, but it stuck with me. I can still remember big chunks of it, and so in one sense, I feel a little guilty talking about a movie I haven't seen in what is probably two decades. But at the same time, I don't really want to rewatch it. But my memory of the love thing is not that it was a choice, but that he was just sort of preternaturally and by circumstance with this person because mm-hmm. she was the other poor kid, the other dejected kid, and he was isolated and she was isolated for different reasons. The implication is that she was a victim of abuse and he was, of course, not, or at least not directly, but rather a victim of circumstance that he had certain developmental and physical issues he was dealing with, mm-hmm. right? And so I never thought that he made a choice to love her and be devoted to her, but that she was sort of just part of the situation that he found himself in, which was a sort of blessed situation, right? There's no father, so therefore the mother becomes a kind of Mary figure. And I just figured that Jenny was the Mary Magdalene figure, that it was part of... It's not like Christ sought out Mary Magdalene. She was just there as a representation of all the things that could go wrong in the world for an innocent person. And that's mm-hmm. what Jenny is as well, right? All the things that could go wrong.
Yeah.
While Forrest Gump is the symbol of all the things that could go right through no volition of one's own. And yet somehow that's what I think makes Forrest Gump the much more annoying character, even though Jenny's somewhat manipulative, as I remember. And I didn't particularly love that character. But in a way, being the dupe of fate and everything turns out bad for you creates sympathy, whereas being the dupe of fate and everything turns out well for you, like it does for Forrest Gump, just creates a sense of indifference at best and at worst kind of annoyance for me.
I think that's a good way to, next time you do watch the movie, and next time, if there is a next time for either of us,
there won't be, but yeah.
but a good, for anyone listening who is about to watch the movie, a good sort of test while you're watching it to constantly think to yourself should I praise Forrest Gump for this? Should I praise
right.
Forrest Gump for that?
Right. And so, this has become a very interesting aside for me. If this is the whole episode, that's fine with me. Let's just bash on Forrest Gump. But no, there's something really interesting about that because I think you're on to something. We're both working with somewhat distant memory, but is there anything that he, or at least the big things? I don't want to try to remember every detail of the movie, right? But I think we're supposed to praise him. But not as a person. I think we're supposed to praise him as a kind of almost like a Christ figure, except he makes even fewer choices than are represented in the life of Christ.
Well, yeah, certain skills and certain inclinations, I would say, and the sort of unnatural thing is that he has them from such a young age, right? That he
right.
sort of naturally does the right thing in certain circumstances. So he sees someone in distress and he wants to go help them out. He's given a ball and told to run, and he's really good at that, right?
He's like crippled at the same time. So there's a good example of like the miraculous in that
yes.
movie, right? Because
yes.
he's got those leg braces. He ostensibly he should not be able to run. Jenny says, "Run, Forrest, run!" And then he can, and the braces break off of his legs, and he's totally whole. It makes no damn sense. And so we can't say, "Well, look, he's overcome it through the security and the force of his will." No, it's pure happenstance. Someone yelled run, he starts trying to run, and there's no causal explanation offered.
Not even that he's true of heart, whatever that might mean.
What the hell would that mean?
I'm trying to imagine if I'm a producer, right? How do I convince Chad to like the movie?
Well, I think that's your best bet, what you just tried, right? And I think that's what Zemeckis is trying to do, is say, well, he's true of heart, and therefore all this good accrues to him. But what does that make Jenny? Like, why is she being abused by ostensibly raped, right? That's the implication I was left with.
Yes.
The inference I made.
She basically is the normal person. She is the every person in all of these circumstances. And she can only sort of look at Forrest Gump the way that the rest of us do, with this kind of surprise and, I don't know, wonder.
True. That's true. But at the same time, she's not in a position to look at him with disdain, which is how a lot of or sort of benign indifference, the way that some people deal with him. I'm not sure what to make of that, but yeah.
Well,
the praise and blame thing, though. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just getting one last point. Maybe this is related to America's obsession with superheroes, right? Because we have Superman and Lois Lane. And Superman, of course, is this alien entity with magical powers, in completely not human. And also morally, at least historic in his earlier forms, he has these implicit goodness in him, right? And then Lois Lane is just supposed to be the every person who's like, whoa, who's that? And then there's a love story between them. So there might be something like that going on between Forrest Gump and Jenny.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, so the superhero is an interesting problem, right? When it comes to morality as well. Mm-hmm. Because can you really... I don't know. Like with Superman, can you praise him for things that just come naturally to him? And yet we're supposed to be in awe of the superhero, and yet not in awe of the superhero in the way that we would be in awe of, say, God. Hmm. Although it's related, maybe, right? But again, the praise and blame thing becomes complicated.
Yeah.
But at the same time, especially in modern incarnations of the superhero, so much of it, Marvel and so on, so much of it does involve deeply human flaws, right? Like the Scarlet Witch, for instance. Like, we're supposed to sympathize because she lost her children in the way that she did.
Hmm. They need to be humanized in some way. And the less human they are, then the harder it is for us to, other than have some kind of power fantasy, right? The harder it is for us to connect with them.
Right. So there's this element of the human all too human. But I don't see that in Forrest Gump. Hmm. When does Forrest Gump do something where you're like, oh, yeah, I've done that. You know, I made that mistake, or I fell into that. He's supposed to be this sort of, on the one hand, a totally unrelatable entity. Like, that's why everyone looks at him in shock and with some awe, right? Like the scene, I do remember the scene of the Vietnam protest pretty well. And when he first comes out, like, people were sort of like, what's this guy going to talk about? And then they're taken with his speech, which we don't get to hear, as I recall, right? Like, we don't get to hear it. So he says something that's so true, apparently, that it just ends the conversation. It seems like it can't be so anti-authoritarian that it stirs them to action, because they're not, but they're also not turned off. They don't find it cynical defense of the status quo either. Zemeckis or the writer, whoever wrote the script, put that speech in an impossible situation. Like, there's no way any speech that you could put in Forrest Gump's mouth at that moment is going to satisfy us. Hmm. So therefore you just leave it blank, right? Which is a cop-out. That's the same reason I hate the ending of that Sofia Coppola movie, or whatever that one's called, with he's an actor I like, and I can't even...
Bill Murray.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Remember at the end, he whispers something in her ear, and we never hear. I hate that kind of stuff. It's like, if you're not a good enough writer to write it, don't pretend that you are.
Lost in Translation, is that the...
That's the movie. I didn't like that one either. So we're going through my prejudices so far in this episode. But you can see why, because we're talking about issues of how we evaluate action. Mm. And if we don't have the action to evaluate, then we can't evaluate it. And that's the case with these speeches that I'm objecting to, right? That all we see is the effect of the speech. We don't get to hear the speech itself. And so that, to me, that's cheating, because you're saying, oh, wow, you've just experienced this great speech, but you didn't experience it at all. You saw other people experience it, and you vicariously understand it to be something that it may or may not be had it actually been actualized. But the more egregious problem that I'm having with this, doesn't pertain as much to Lost in Translation, but certainly to Forrest Gump, is that how do we evaluate the character at all if we don't, it seems like all the things that come out of the character aren't through choice or through any kind of lived reaction to life, but rather just an emanation of the purity of character. Mm-hmm. Now, this relates to Aristotle in a couple different ways. Because on the one hand, what we're about to turn to is the whole notion of the voluntary. And it seems to me Forrest Gump doesn't apply here, except as a negative counterexample. But on the other hand, what we're going to be talking about is this idea, eventually, we'll be talking about, and we've already been talking about it, and we're going to come back to talking about this idea that virtuous acts are an emanation in some way of virtuous character. With the three conditions that Eric's already mentioned and that we've discussed in a previous episode, you have the three conditions that a virtuous act must be done from knowledge, right? It's not done by accident. Again, Forrest Gump probably doesn't apply for most of that movie to this. It has to be done... You have to choose the virtuous thing for its own sake, not exclusively for its own sake. You can also, for instance, you could be generous because you want to make the world better, right? But you're also being generous for the sake of generosity. So it doesn't have to be exclusively for its own sake, but it has to be also for its own sake. And then finally, as Eric pointed out, it has to be a demonstration of a stable character, right? It's not that if the thief... sees someone drops their purse and gives it back this one time on a whim, that's not virtue. It has to come out of a stable character.
Yeah.
And so this idea of emanation then, which does apply to Forrest Gump, it seems to me, but what is emanating for me in Forrest Gump, what we're witnessing, the emanation that we're witnessing is not the emanation of a virtuous character, because for, Aristotle, that requires knowledge, and it requires a sort of remove and more or less objective thought process. And you never really see that. In fact, I think we're encouraged not to see that in Forrest Gump. He's supposed to be, as you said, pure of heart. And so thinking just gets in the way of that. And to me, that's a very kind of gross romanticism. The idea that thinking gets in the way of our better intentions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably enough.
And then how do we build up to that question of thought then of someone working from reason, right? Because Aristotle is a very careful thinker, and he usually tries to set things up sort of stepwise, step by step. Usually, I mean, with some kind of something that his audience would take as obvious, right? As sort of like. Like at the beginning of the very first chapter of book three, he's talking about, people being praised or blamed,
right.
For things that they're basically responsible for, or maybe the word responsible is too strong here, but things that are voluntary. And then they're sometimes pitied or at least excused if it's not their fault, right? So this question of fault or what is voluntary, what emanates from them. These three things, there's already an ambiguity in there of something being your fault, something being your responsibility, or something just coming from you. He's trying to tease out these things. What makes one of these different than the other? And so he wants to start from the broadest possible scope of what makes something come from you, and then he can narrow down to something that comes closer to accountability.
Yeah. Yeah, and he does it in, as you already pointed out, more eloquently than I'm about to, he does it in a very typical way for him, which is he starts with common opinion and common procedure, the way that people tend to act. People in the world praise and blame each other, right? So what's the basis of that? And that's how he's starting. So instead of saying, okay, what does it mean to do something voluntarily? Instead of starting there, he gets there by starting with, well, how do we react to people based on action, right? Or not even just action, actually, because he also is talking about things that happen to people. So it's not just action. So, for instance, if one of the examples he gives is the wind blows boat off course or whatever, right? Or a kidnapper takes you away and you miss an appointment or whatever it is that you miss, right? Those aren't actions. You being kidnapped is not your action. It's someone else's action. The boat being blown off course isn't your action. You're trying to resist it. That's nature's action, if anything, right? Yeah. So he's dealing with both action and things that happen to you. And he's asking the question, so where do we assign praise and blame, and how does that work? And it's a kind of interesting strategy, right? It's an indirect strategy, but it's sort of one where you're like, oh yeah, I do that, right? I do praise people for some things and then think praise is inappropriate, praise or blame is inappropriate in other situations. So let's dig down into why that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess for him, a good place to start is this idea of the voluntary. I don't have the original, you know, Greek on me, but basically my understanding is that he's thinking of something being just an internal impulse of some kind or of your own accord. When something is right. voluntary, he means it in the sense that it's sort of this, it's like a self-moving. When you are self-moving, then it's voluntary. And that's a fairly strict way of interpreting it. And we can, we'll eventually see why that is. But it starts off with a few sort of counterintuitive ideas about how do we even assign, an action to a person. You know, maybe that's the first step, is how do we assign an action to a person? In other words, how do we say something really is an action or just sort of an action in name only? And that seems to be his first basic step, right? Okay. So how do we connect an action to someone's character is the sort of next step after that. And it's an interesting problem because basically he recognizes that when we say something is involuntary, when it's not really your impulse, we often mean it in two different ways. We mean it because something made you do it externally or because you didn't know any better.
Right.
And, this, of course, is sort of his way into trying to define genuine action. But it's still it's still an interesting kind of complication that he's dealing with early on.
It's sort of almost a further instance of indirection, right? Because what we're really looking to assess is the voluntary. And what he starts off with is praise and blame. And then when he goes into that issue further, he starts with the involuntary, right? It seems like it's easier to say what is not voluntary than what is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And in fact, he'll eventually introduce the term non-voluntary. So you sort of have these three levels, or maybe the involuntary, according to people like Taylor, and he's probably right about this, maybe, I don't know, that the involuntary is a sort of subset of the non-voluntary, right? Mm. That your basic division is between the things that you do or things that are done to you that you will, that are voluntary, or that you will in some fashion. And then the rest is non-voluntary, and we'll get into the distinction between non-voluntary and involuntary later. Mm-hmm. But at first, he does use the term for involuntary. He doesn't introduce non-voluntary until later. And he says that, as Eric just pointed out, there are two ways in which something can be involuntary. You could be forced to do it, or you could do it through a lack of knowledge. And first he turns to force, right? Mm-hmm. And that sometimes we're put in a situation where, there are certain obvious issues of force, right? Force is something where the origin of the action or of the thing happening is external, and that the agent, and then he says in parentheses, or rather the person to whom the thing happens, because the whole point is that the person's not functioning as an agent in this situation, that they contribute nothing. And he gives an example. If I'm carried away by the wind or by men who have won in their power, if I'm kidnapped, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm kidnapped, then the thing was external. Obviously is external. I didn't kidnap myself, right? I didn't simply run away. I've been kidnapped. So the beginning of the act, the event, the cause of it was external to me. And I contributed nothing to it. I didn't, right? I didn't contribute to my own kidnapping.
Yeah, it is so, it's such an obvious and straightforward, like everyone would agree that that's not voluntary or involuntary.
Yeah. Until you start thinking about concrete things, because then you ask yourself, well, what about Patty Hearst? She didn't agree to be kidnapped, but didn't she become complicit? And then you can say, well, that's Stockholm Syndrome. That's not really her fault. But you can see how things become complicated very quickly once we get to particulars, right? And so he's not going all the way down to the particular case here yet. At any rate, he then goes on to the idea of what he thinks of as mixed cases, right? And this is getting closer to what we usually get ourselves worked up about when it comes to involuntary action. He goes, well, what about, let's say, a tyrant kidnaps your family and threatens them with death if you don't do something that you personally find egregious, right? Mm-hmm. And in order to save your family, you do it. Is that voluntary or involuntary? And for him, he says, well, that's mixed, right? In one sense, it's involuntary because it's involuntary, as he puts it, without qualification, meaning that it's not something you wanted to do, right?
Yeah,
It's voluntary with the qualification that you were doing it because you wanted something else. So you wanted to save your family. You saw that as a fine and noble end. And so you do something base and ignoble in order to attain for the greater good, in other words.
Yeah. Right? And with that qualification stuff, it seems like he's sort of throwing a bone to people who probably most of his readership who think, well, even within these mixed cases, even when you feel just sort of a compulsion, an external compulsion to do something. Anyone who works in a hierarchy generally feels like, oh yeah, sometimes I have to do things that I don't really think are right or whatever. But usually we, in an everyday sense, and that's his sort of, without qualification thing, in an everyday sense, we say, oh, well, that's okay. I understand. You this wasn't really your choice. But he has sort of a surprising approach to that problem where he says, well, actually, there's a voluntary aspect to these mixed things.
In fact, he says there's more emphasis on the voluntary than the involuntary. He says that they more closely resemble voluntary actions, for they are choice-worthy at the time when they are done. So the way I read that, and you tell me if you find it, let's say that we're in a situation, our kids have been kidnapped or being held by this malicious tyrant who says you have to, I don't know, embezzle from your place of work X amount of money, and then I will free them, right? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I'll kill them. And so you embezzle the money. Now, embezzling is something you would never normally do, and that's why it's when it's without qualification, it's something you would never have chosen for yourself. You're only choosing it under duress. But what Aristotle is saying is that you're still choosing it, that there's still a choice. Mm-hmm. You could let the tyrant kill your family, but that would probably be the wrong, especially when it comes to embezzlement, that would be the wrong answer, right? Mm-hmm. Even though you're doing something egregious, you're doing it for ultimately a better goal, but you still, there's no point in pretending that it's not a choice, right? Because saving your family was choice worthy. Mm-hmm. In fact, in one sense, what you're doing in this sense is you're taking away the bit of the ability that you have in this situation, right? If you're saying that, well, I was totally forced into all of it. Well, no, actually, you're denigrating the part that was good in what you were doing, that you were doing it for the sake of saving people that you care about or that mm-hmm. shouldn't have to lose their lives.
Yeah, so I guess Aristotle is doing one of his Aristotelian things and asking, what exactly are you being forced to do? When we say someone is being forced in that way, what exactly are they being forced? Because they're still doing it, the thing that they do still comes from inside of them.
Right.
So where's that? And maybe were you gonna? I don't know what your interpretation of this. My sort of basic one is just that we're being forced to weigh our priorities. That we have to sort of decide the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's it. I think there's something really interesting about the thought. I would hope that none of this happens to any of us. Whether you know. Even if you're a fan of Forrest Gump, I would hope that none of this would happen to us. But these extreme situations do sort of put you in a kind of ranking of what's important and what's not, right? Mm-hmm. That clearly the survival of your loved ones is more important than embezzling funds, even a great amount of funds. Mm-hmm. But we will come up against one in a bit. That may or may not, because Aristotle, if you remember in a previous chapter, has said there are certain things that you never do no matter what. And one of those things was matricide. And so he's going to bring that up again in a moment, but we'll get there in just a bit. So then he goes on to the issue of that in certain situations, like the ones we just described, people might even be praised, right, when they endure something shameful because it's for the sake of something better, for the sake of something fine. But if it's the reverse, and here the term reverse is a little bit strange to me, but because to me the reverse would be that you endure something great in order for something shameful, and that's not what he's about to say here. He says if it's the reverse, they are censured, since enduring the most shameful things for the sake of nothing fine. or a small thing of that kind is the mark of a bad person. In some cases, praise is not accorded, but excuse when one does something one should not because of things that overstrain human nature and which no one would endure. To me, those are two different things. So first of all, the censure, I shouldn't have read those two sentences, right? They are right next to each other, but I should have separated them. The first thing is dealing with censure, right? That the person has made the wrong assessment of the hierarchy of value, basically. That let's say that... that you say, oh, well, go kill your mom or else I'm going to stomp this bug and you kill your mom. That's not praiseworthy, obviously, right? That your hierarchy of values is all screwed up. Mm-hmm. But then the second sentence that I read is something else. It involves excuse, right? That sometimes we are dealing with somebody where the human nature is just overstrained. And we could even use that same example, perhaps, right? If someone has a gun to my kid's head, I would probably do just about anything. Mm-hmm. And I would probably excuse other people for doing just about anything. I mean, I can think of some things that I'd rather not say because they're so beyond the pale and so gross that in that situation, right? And, mm-hmm. and for Aristotle, matricide would be one of those things, which is reasonable to me. Why would I kill one loved one for another? Like, that's a calculus I can't imagine doing, the sort of Sophie's Choice kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, the fact that he's raising these it depends sort of situations when we're in response to the question of whether something is praiseworthy or blameworthy, the fact that he's saying, well, it depends, suggests that that's not really what his point is at this stage, right? That for him, the question is whether the action is characteristic or uncharacteristic, whether it comes from you or if it's really not part of you. Right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there are no recommendations for whether or not we should praise or blame in certain. He's just saying that one does often. Yeah. In some cases, praise is not accorded, but excuse, and so on. Right. He's not saying how things ought to be delineated, but rather that this is what goes on.
And so, if it's too soon to talk about praise or blame, then maybe the bar for what we're talking about with force needs to be raised a little bit. That seems to be his argument, right? Where normally, there's sort of a low bar for the involuntary when we're talking about force. That like, it wasn't really his fault. He was made to do it. He was told by a superior to do it or whatever, just following orders, etc. Right? Normally, that's sort of a low bar, but he's saying, well, if we're separating the praiseworthiness and blameworthiness of actions, right, if that's not really what we're talking about here, then we can then be a little bit stricter when we're talking about what we're calling voluntary. You know, if it strictly comes from you, if you are the sort of source of the action, whatever that action is, then we can just simply call it voluntary.
Right. Great. That's a perfect transition to what I'm about to ask you. I'm going to read the sentence again about excuse. In some cases, praise is not accorded, but excuse when one does something one should not because of things that overstrain human nature and which no one would endure. Is this a mixed case or is this a straightforward involuntary? Right? Because if it overstrains human nature and no one can endure it, then can I really be said to make a choice?
I think that's a good point. If it's universally unendurable, then it might as well be the wind pushing you one direction
exactly.
or the other. Yeah,
that's exactly my point. Yeah, but I can't tell what Aristotle's saying here. Because he puts it in the paragraph, obviously, of mixed cases, but this doesn't seem to be a mixed case. Or is it just, here's the exception where it's not a mixed case, that I'm just throwing that in the middle to show the ultimate extreme? But he doesn't clarify, at least as far as I could tell.
Yeah, I mean, if he's being super strict, he might still say, even if it's universally unendurable, even if anyone would do that, as long as it's the person doing it, then it's still the cause of it is still coming from them.
But if there's no choice, then it's not about voluntary, right? Choice has to be in place for voluntary. So if it overstrains human nature to the point, like, let's imagine, you're laughing because I'm about to put together another hypothetical. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, no. I was thinking of the idea of choice here. He hasn't even gotten to choice yet, right? I think he's sort of separating. In many ways, the voluntary is before choice.
No, I don't agree with that.
Oh, okay.
Because as you said earlier, the voluntary, or rather virtue, is a state that is associated with choice. Mm-hmm. And now he's trying to figure out what makes something voluntary. And the answer is going to be that voluntarism involves choice. And then we're going to go into choice more in the next chapter. But I don't think that voluntarism precedes choice. Voluntarism's bound up in choice. There is no voluntary without choice. Hmm. Is there?
I guess I'm seeing the voluntary and the involuntary as very generally applying to pretty much any living creature, right? Including, you know, for Aristotle, children and animals. Whereas moral choice is sort of a subset of the voluntary, right? But he's I think just talking in the most general sense. This is why he's allowed to sort of raise the bar for involuntary forced action, even to the point of the universally unendurable stuff.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. The reason that you're definitely right that the voluntary applies to children and animals, but choice doesn't. You're definitely right about that. And that makes choice a subset of the voluntary. So I totally agree with all that. The reason that I'm pushing for choice in this situation is because there seems to me whenever we're doing any, even if we're coerced, we're doing something, we still make the choice whether to do it or not. As long as we're doing it, right? And to me, the idea of overstraining human nature, granted, he doesn't give us an example other than a negative example that we're about to have. And I'm assuming that that the example that we had of the loved ones could be construed as overstraining human nature. Mm-hmm. But he had said a moment ago that that was a mixed case. So is this different and more extreme, or does that apply here, in which case... Granted, we're being very rigorous in saying that, well, it's still because there was a choice made, you could have done nothing, I suppose, and let your loved ones die. Mm-hmm. So you still chose to do something, even though anyone in this situation would have done that. Why I'm after choice. But the points you made are absolutely right, and I'm not at all disagreeing with that.
But even on the most basic level of kind of the idea of the voluntary as being a general kind of internal impulse, that is kind of a good question of, in those universally unendurable cases, where's the line between the sort of external principle of change and just the internal principle of change?
Exactly. Because if I'm asleep and you grab my hand and slap my sister Jessica, I don't know why I decided I was going to have you slap Jessica, but right, that if you slapped her with my hand, and she goes, what the hell's wrong with you? To me, I could legitimately say I didn't do that, mm-hmm. right? Even though it was my hand, you were using me as an instrument, and I was unconscious at the time, so there was no way I contributed in any way, right? And you can't even use the other kind of thing that people sometimes use of, well, I should have chosen not to fall asleep or something because I had no idea any of this. There was no reason for me to choose not to, right? Like people say, well, I didn't do that really because I was drunk when that happened. And so it wasn't really me. Yeah. But you decided to allow yourself to get drunk. And therefore I could see blame still being attributed to you because you chose to put yourself in a situation where you couldn't do things responsibly. Mm. Whereas if somebody was Mickey'd and they did something egregious, then I don't think I can blame them in the same way, right? Mm-hmm. I guess you could say, well, you put yourself in a situation where you could get Mickey'd, but how did you know that? Again, it depends on circumstances, but I can certainly imagine a situation where I'm just at a restaurant, totally innocently at a restaurant, and someone spikes my drink. And you know, I didn't have any, maybe it's a total stranger. Like, it's not like you could say, well, you should have made better choices in the people you're hanging out with, right?
Well, that brings us to the question of knowing or not knowing, which is the sort of second, the second bar, and generally, normally the higher bar, that he's kind of, dealing with for the involuntary. And he would basically say, well, if you got Mickey'd in that situation, would you feel regret about that? Do you feel like you made choices that put yourself in that situation?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, but you can regret. Let's get to that in one second. Mm-hmm. First, we got to deal with Euripides because the regret thing's interesting to me, and we definitely need to talk about it. But let's get to the Euripides example, because he's just said this thing about overstraining human nature. And then he says, but there are some things which perhaps one cannot be necessitated to do, but one should rather die having suffered the most terrible things. And indeed, the things that necessitated Euripides, Euripides's Alcmaeon, his character Alcmaeon, and this is a play that doesn't survive, but we know the basic plot, right? To commit matricide appear absurd. So the things that forced Alcmaeon to kill his mother are absurd. And like I said, we know the basic plot, so I can tell you what it was.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what made Alcmaeon kill his mother.
So Alcmaeon's father said, "Look, your mother's he had a premonition or something along those lines, or was told by a prophet that a seer." That his wife was going to be involved in his demise, right? And he said, so after I'm dead, I don't know why after, should have been before, but after I'm dead, you have to kill your mother. Mm-hmm. And Alcmaeon had no particular interest in killing his mother, but his father said, otherwise you will suffer my curse. And to Aristotle, that's ridiculous, mm-hmm. right? That he chose this undoable thing, matricide, to avoid mm-hmm. a curse. He would have been better off just allowing himself mm-hmm. to be cursed, I guess, in Aristotle's assessment.
Yeah. It's not too far from the Hamlet story with the sort of ghost of Hamlet's father, like compelling him to act the way that he does.
Right. Right. And so for Aristotle, because you've gone beyond the pale here, but let's say that, I don't know, that maybe it's not human nature, but humans within a certain context might have such a overwhelming fear of a curse that they would do things that are beyond the pale. I don't know. I mean, could we use the overstrains human nature excuse for Alcmaeon, or is that, I mean, clearly Aristotle thinks we can't, but
a lot of that comes back to that issue of, ranking priorities. If
right.
maybe your culture is such that whatever your ancestors say is the most important thing, possibly there's more of an excuse there. I don't know.
And certainly there are cultures, and I think to some extent Hamlet flirts with this, where the dead are accorded more honor than the living, right? That the dead ancestors are the ones that you should obey more, which of course makes things difficult since they're dead and your access to them is filtered, but I don't know. But there's an example of where I get a little confused, like, why does the overstraining human nature, first of all, what is the nature of the overstraining human nature argument? Is it saying that it's still a mixed case or that it's involuntary? And we've already discussed the complexity there. I don't think it's a totally answerable question. And then, why does Alcmaeon get such a hard time from Aristotle? And why does he show up right after we've introduced the argument of overstraining human nature? Because obviously Alcmaeon, in Aristotle's view, shouldn't have been overstrained. It should have been obvious to him that committing matricide is going beyond the pale.
No, it seems like he's just sort of offering two extreme examples on opposite ends of the extreme. One, examples where anyone would do that versus examples where, isn't it kind of ridiculous that person did that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in either way, there's that question of where exactly is the person just an instrument of external forces? And in some ways it seems like Aristotle's just saying, well, who knows exactly, but it's a pretty high bar now in a way that you might not normally think.
Yeah. And then before he moves on to error, we're getting there, I promise, but there's one more thing, right? Which is this sort of what I'm calling evidence from affect, which I'm curious to see if you think that's a decent moniker. Mm-hmm. But let me read the opening of this paragraph. If one were to say that pleasant and fine things are forcible on the ground that they are external things which necessitate, one would have to count everything as occurring by force, right? Mm-hmm. So he's moving on to an argument that we hear a lot. It's not my fault that I committed robbery. Poverty made me do it. Mm-hmm. It's not my fault that I committed, adultery or whatever. The history of my abuse made me do it or whatever. Or it's not my fault that I overeat. It's the things, those beautiful cakes. I can't resist them.
Yeah, and that's in many ways the kind of example he probably has in mind. The more sort of we might think of them as the sort of positive things that kind of drive us forward. You're just standing there and on a street corner, and then you see just a big pot of gold in the other corner. And so, you're going to walk up to it, right? Wouldn't anyone just walk up to that big pot of gold, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so now so this idea of the everything external could be thought of as a compulsion, right? So if I'm particularly given to alcohol, right? Then I could say, well, it's not that I decided to drink. I can't help it. It's a compulsion. I see whiskey, I have to drink it, right? And so aren't I excused because it was forced on me, right? And he says, well, you could describe everything that way then. Mm-hmm. Because we only do, most of what we do, maybe all of what we do, is on the basis of desire. Whether that desire is curbed or controlled mm-hmm. or not is almost immaterial here. It's still desire, right? Even if I'm a temperate person and I have a pretty good control over my desires and I channel them in the right way, I still have desires. And so you could, and you know, the desires might be perfectly virtuous desires, like the safety of my children or whatever. But then I would say, well, I'm compelled to do this thing, right? Mm-hmm. And he says that people who act under forcible compulsion and involuntarily find it distressing, and this is why I'm calling it an argument from affect or evidence from affect, mm-hmm. right? That because when I overeat, I don't find the overeating distressing. I find the overeating indulgent and enjoyable. I might find my self-image distressing or, you know, various things other than that. And so he makes an interesting point here. So he says, so we find it distressing, but those who act for the sake of the pleasant and fine, of course, do so with pleasure. It's absurd to count external things as the cause of what one does rather than oneself for being readily ensnared by such things, and to count oneself as the cause of one's fine actions, but pleasant things as the cause of one's shameful ones, which I think is a very interesting argument, right? That he's because there's a psychological aspect here. He's saying that people are psychologically prone to take credit for the things that they're proud of, mm-hmm. right? And say, well, you know, I take care of my family, therefore I did that. But I also, let's not keep doing the overeating thing. I also, well, this is the same kind of thing, but I also overindulge in drinking, but I'm not responsible for that because the drinking is forced on me through external circumstance and mm-hmm. addiction and so on. But taking care of my children is internal.
Yeah. Politicians sort of have to use that logic, or not have to, but they often do, right? Where
right.
Whenever something good happens, they jump up and say, well, that was me all along. And then whenever something terrible happens, it was their enemies, right?
That's right. I mean, the economy is the best example of that, right? Yeah. Like, oh, the economy is great. Well, that's really just the inheritance of some the previous president's economic measures, right? And you don't get credit for that. Mm-hmm. That is an interesting argument.
So it's so obviously absurd. I kind of see this as a final, you know, reductio ad absurdum kind of argument, yeah. right? Where if someone says it couldn't any, you know, couldn't this be a compulsion? Couldn't that be a compulsion? And then Aristotle says, okay, sure, maybe anything can be a compulsion, in which case,
right.
you know, that's absurd. It doesn't make any sense. So in fact, he's sort of arguing the exact opposite, that almost nothing is truly something that's forced on us.
Right, almost nothing, yeah.
Yeah.
In part because of the idea that we have some kind of, not control. Well, we do have some kind of, at least the possibility of control over our desires. That's what temperance is, right? Hmm. Is trying to work out our relationship to our desires. I might have a desire for indulgence in alcohol, right? And I might take that too far, but I can. I know there are certain 12-step programs that don't necessarily agree with this, and maybe they're right. I don't know. How do I know? But one can imagine that for at least some people, you can go too far and overindulge in alcohol for a few years or whatever, let's say, and then you're like, you know what? That's too much. I'm only going to drink once on special occasions, and I'm going to limit myself at all times to two beers or whatever, and that's not enough to get me out of hand or to have a hangover the next day, and that's what I've decided. And you can make those decisions and enforce them, right? Mm-hmm. And so if that's possible for you, then you're involved in that. Even if you are compelled by external things, you decide, to some extent at least, through And I don't mean all at once, right? Like, this is where it gets complicated, because I could sound, I'm hearing myself talk, and I can imagine someone saying, that person is a scold. And I'm not a scold, actually. Right? And so I can, I'm not saying that it's easy, right? And I don't think Aristotle's saying it's easy, because that's his whole point of habituation, right? That the first time I decide, and I guess I'm using alcohol just to, so it's clear to everybody, as my example, because I've had problems with alcohol in the past, right? So I'm speaking of something that's familiar to me. I feel bad talking about overindulgence of food, because that's never been an issue for me, but alcohol has. So that's why I feel more comfortable talking about that in some ways, just to be clear and not seem like a scold, because I know from experience it's not easy. That first time that you say no to a drink, that's not the end of it, right? It's not like you're just, oh, well, now I'm a non-drinker, or now I'm a responsible drinker, whereas before I was a somewhat irresponsible one. Mm-hmm. That in order to become a responsible drinker, you have to do it the right way over and over and over again until it's no longer really an issue.
Yeah, it's not like you just did a chore and then you can sort of be like, yep, all done.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And yet, as long as there's a sliver of a choice for Aristotle, it seems, and this is his rigorism, or the, what were you calling it? His, you didn't say harsh. What did you say?
Oh, just that. I think it's him being very general here. This is even before, this is even before choice in the way that he's going to talk about it. This is sort of prior to choice. It's just whether the principle of change is inside of you or not.
Right. And as long as there's some kind of principle of change inside of you, then it is voluntary for him. And to him, it's closer to the voluntary than the involuntary in these mixed cases. And so that might seem hard, right? But remember, also, he's not yet making any recommendations about our judgment of these people.
Yeah.
He's just saying that, like it or not, choice was involved. Mm-hmm. You know, and so you or
that's a good way to put it. Whether or not it was a good choice is then that's a different kind of question.
Right.
Yeah.
So now we move on to error. So you want to get us started on error? It says everything done through error is non-voluntary. So what goes on with error?
Probably for him, this was the easier one, because this is the sort of bar that he brings force up to. Right. So for most of us, when we think about whether something was done in ignorance or not, whether we knew what we were doing, it kind of is straightforward. If someone didn't know what they were doing, we kind of, we're able to judge pretty quickly whether we believe them or not, right? When someone says, oh, I didn't know, sometimes it rings true and sometimes it rings false. And he's able to sort of just draw on our common views about that to point out some interesting things. For one thing, he talks about when we do something that that we regret, right? If we feel a kind of pain afterwards, that's an important sign that it was involuntary. We can keep going into particular situations too. Yeah.
Well, regret's the distinction between the voluntary, the non-voluntary, and the involuntary, right? Mm. So, and that's why I think Taylor's right that it's ultimately a wider that you have the voluntary and you have the non-voluntary, and then the involuntary is a subset ultimately of the non-voluntary, because it's the non-voluntary with regret.
Yeah.
So if I accidentally do something, like let's say I accidentally do things all the time, right? I accidentally brush shoulders with someone passing me. I probably don't regret that if it's just brushing, because it didn't hurt anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the big deal? But if I accidentally shoulder check somebody, like I didn't see they were there, and maybe I feel I should have, or that could go either way. I might think, well, why weren't they? They saw I was there. Why didn't they avoid the shoulder check, right? Mm-hmm. But if something happens that I didn't intend, but I regret it, then that's the involuntary rather than the non-voluntary. For Aristotle,
so,
right? Because he wants he just wants a terminological distinction for those two things.
That totally makes sense, because whenever he recognizes that he's talking about two different things, even if there's not a name for it, he's like, well, we better find a name for it, because I'm talking about it.
Right. And so you can see why I wanted what I was calling the affective evidence from affection or whatever here, because part of how he's determining what makes something involuntary has to do with affect, has to do with regret, right? And it's the absence of affect that makes it non-voluntary.
Yeah, feeling is an important sign of whether something is voluntary or not. Yeah, and if it has anything to do with character at all.
Exactly, because then it comes back to character, right? That the idea is that my feeling tells me about my character. If the action is indeterminate with respect to character, feeling is less so, right? Because if I can say, well, look, that guy just gave the woman's purse back, and I find out later, well, that's a thief. He did that on a whim and thought it was funny. Like, he almost did it as a form of kind of acting out sarcasm, right? Like, look, I'm this great thief, but here I'm giving back the purse in this one instance, right? Then we don't think of that as a virtuous act. If he's trying to change his ways and he's trying to amend, we might think of that as the beginning of a virtuous act, but not yet, at least for Aristotle, not yet fully virtuous, because he's not yet in a stable character in this scenario.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And then the next stage after this is he has two different kinds of ignorance he's talking about.
Right.
I'm sure there are different translations of it, but it's a little bit confusing regardless of which translation when you read it, because he sort of brings it up suddenly. He's like, well, action caused by ignorance would seem to be different from action done in ignorance.
Right.
And then, of course, we're left scratching our heads. Okay, how is action caused by ignorance different than done in it? What the hell is he talking about?
Right.
But it's still a useful distinction that he's ultimately making.
Well, what is the distinction? How does it work?
Well, basically, he seems to be pointing at a kind of general ignorance versus particular ignorance, and ignorance of a particular situation versus the kind of general principle of the thing. And he gives the example of, actually, back to, since you're talking about alcohol, he gives the example of drunkenness. If the person is drunk or angry, his action seems to be caused by drunkenness or anger. So if you're in a fit of rage, or if you've been drinking heavily, then your action seems to be caused by that, not by ignorance. Though it is done in ignorance, right? So right. You have sort of put yourself in a state of ignorance through a prior choice of some kind.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's interesting, right? In ignorance. And I think the way you just said it is the exact right way. I'm just repeating it, not because I'm doing it better, but just to repeat it for emphasis, which is that you've put yourself in a state, right? So you, let's say that you're, like most of us, you're a broadly virtuous person, but not in the super strict Aristotelian sense, which might be impossible, right? So you haven't attained the level of the Stoic sage or something, but you try to make good decisions for the most part, but you allow yourself some indulgences, let's say alcohol, right? And you overdo it in this instance, and you do stupid things. Well, where's the moral responsibility? Is it through the act that you or with respect to the act that you actually manifested that you did? I was looking for a better way. That sounds so clumsy. The act that you did, but is it from what you did directly? In other words, I'm drunk and I'm sort of flailing around and I punch somebody in the mouth, right? I would never flail that way if I wasn't drunk or be that unaware of my surroundings. Now, I didn't intentionally hit the person in the mouth, but I put myself in a state where that was more of a possibility than it would have been had I drank moderately or not drank at all.
And as a principle, right? You probably should have known better, right? That's the sort of implication there.
Exactly. And so there's this interesting set of levels that are now occurring, right? That on the one hand, no matter what, I should have known better in a crowded bar to flail my arms around, right? Whether I was drunk or not. But I've put myself in a state where I've allowed myself to forget that. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's in error.
Yeah.
I put myself in a condition of error.
I like that that phrase, allowing yourself to forget, is kind of a good way to put this idea of being in error. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that applies to anger too, right? We allow ourselves to get so angry that we forget the bounds of what's reasonable and what's not. And so we say, I mean this even in very quotidian ways, right? I think we've all probably been guilty of being angry and saying something that we either totally didn't mean or that we meant, but we wish we hadn't actually said. Mm-hmm. Right.
And then as long as we say you're allowing yourself to forget, then there's clearly an action happening there, or something that comes from you. So there's a voluntary aspect to that.
Right. And that's what I think is interesting. And I'm curious what you think of this, because to me, there are a couple levels of action here, right? On the one hand, I don't think that the drunk person who's flailing and hits the person, they didn't intend to hit the person. So they're only marginally guilty of striking the person. They did strike the person, but they didn't strike the person. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like if I'm accidentally hitting you, like in my shoulder check example, if I see someone coming and I'm like, and I've done this because I'm an asshole sometimes, or at least I used to be, right? New York is one of those places where I think people ought to be walking on the right of the sidewalk.
Yeah, exact same thought. That's so funny.
Yeah. And so they're coming at you. You see they're in your space and you're like, why should I move? I'm in the right spot. I'm not taking up exorbitant amount of space. They're walking, three abreast and it's a narrow sidewalk and I'm just by myself and I'm the one that's got to wait and get on a stoop while they pass by. Why? How is that fair? And so there have been times in my life where I've taken that, now I would say, too far, and I just adamantly refused to move, mm-hmm. right? And so the shoulder check, I knew it was coming. In one sense, I don't feel I caused it because I was in my lane, right? I have a great example of this that doesn't come from my experience. It comes from my wife's. When my wife was a kid and just starting to drive on her own, she turned at a right and didn't look carefully enough, and someone was coming. The person hit her, rear-ended her. Mm-hmm. And of course, she's at fault for this because she went and didn't look carefully enough. She turned on a red. It wasn't illegal at that spot to turn on a red.
Yep.
The woman who hit her told her, I could have stopped. I saw that what you were doing. I had enough time to stop, but I thought you needed to learn a lesson.
Wow.
Now that's really interesting, right? Wow. Because this applies to what we're talking about, because my wife did something in error, right? It wasn't in exactly in error.
It was because she knew the principle. Even if you're allowed to turn right at a red light, right? You're supposed to stop before turning right and look and make sure it's clear. And she knew the principle of that, or should have known the principle of that.
Right. Yeah. And that's why it's through error rather than in error, right? Because there's nothing preventing her from having looked. She just made a mistake. She's a young driver at this point, and she made a mistake. She didn't look carefully enough. Right. I'll have to ask her if she remembers how well she looked or not. But at any rate, this idea of sort of allowing the consequences, you can't even call them natural consequences because the woman could have stopped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I figure that's why God invented the horn. Right. You can show your anger pretty clearly by and then, you know, you also don't screw up your own car in the process.
Right. It's such a bizarre stance to take, right? it's sort of like my shoulder check one, but the only thing that I'm going to get out of the shoulder check one probably is a sore shoulder. I could get a punch in the nose. Mm-hmm. That was threatened at one point, which is why I eventually gave up the practice. And you know, I think it's dumb anyway in retrospect. But the idea is here that you know, What is the larger point here? I've sort of lost the thread.
You're talking about from the perspective of someone who's sort of teaching a lesson, right? And I think that's kind of, I don't know, does Aristotle even enter that problem, right? I have no idea. But one of the issues with involuntary here, I guess that you're getting at is this, it's almost like in the legal scenario of involuntary manslaughter, right? Where mm-hmm. Someone clearly did the wrong thing or did something that we would judge to be wrong. But there are extenuating circumstances or something that kind of suggests that had things gone otherwise, it wouldn't have happened, right? In just a sort of more subtle way. That's the sort of allowing yourself to forget problem. Mm. And that's the mixed case in this scenario.
I gotcha. Yeah. No, I think, and that's why you see the anecdote with my wife as being in error rather than through error.
Then we get the judge, jury, and executioner over there who's like, "I'm going to teach you a lesson."
Right. Like,
well, I mean, I think that's the proper angry response would probably be the horn honk and the slamming on the brakes, or even like if it's a two-lane road and there's no one on the other side, just quickly driving around the person while honking, you know.
Right.
You know,
which is ultimately why I think I was wrong in the shoulder checking. It's like, you know, if I saw it and I could have avoided bumping up with someone else, even if I think they're ultimately being rude, It's like,
yeah, you kind of want to draw attention to their rudeness, though. I get that. This is, and Aristotle would probably agree with you that they are allowing themselves to forget whatever the sort of right situation.
But it's so tricky. Like I came across a similar situation today, actually, because I stopped by Target to get milk, and I'm driving up to get to a place where I'm going to park, and I always park to the side of the building because then it's easy access. Doesn't matter. It's just where I park, and there's no harm in it. I'm not saying it's a virtue or a non-virtue. There's a woman that's walking to Target. She had plenty of space on either side to be near the cars or near the grass. She chose neither, walked in the middle of the road. What the hell am I supposed to do? And I was tempted to honk at her or to roll down the window and say, "Miss, what are you thinking?" You know? And I wound up, I chose to do neither because I'm like, do I want to be in the position of a scold? And for the most part, I don't think of myself as a scold. So I was acting out my character, or at least what I want my character to be, which is not a scold. Mm-hmm. But I'm still sort of, now that we're talking about it, I'm still,
you're still kind of mad at her. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's definitely true. I saw her later in the store, and I was like, "You're a real jerk," you know, because she's, you know, doing all the sort of things that you do when you're a jerk. She's on her cell phone, walking right smack dab in the middle. There was no way I could get around her, even though it's a 2-lane area. She was so smack dab in the middle, and I'm in a van. There was no way I could get around her without it being obvious that I'm pushing by her. You know what I mean? So to me, that is so she put herself in a position where she allowed herself to forget basic etiquette. Like, she's the only person in the world at this moment as far as she's concerned.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Or at least that's my interpretation of it, which might not be fair. But you can see how when we get to concrete particular situations, I still don't know whether letting it go was the right thing. Like, I do think that a certain amount of righteous indignation is, and Aristotle clearly thinks that it is the right response, that that sometimes we do have to be scolds. We have to police each other's behavior, to some extent, at least. And so you can see that we're starting to get muddied down by particulars, but this is where it's going to end up, and it's getting complicated now because we're thinking of these levels of action. And so, in one sense, I could say, well, look, she was so caught up in her own, let's imagine that I'm trying to be as empathetic as I can be with her, right? And say, well, she was so caught up in her phone conversation that she really was oblivious to her surroundings. And so in one sense, she's not at fault. She wasn't blocking me intentionally. She just was so caught up in her own business that she allowed herself to forget. But she allowed herself to forget. Yeah. Right. If it were in her habit to simply walk, as I think she should, to walk to an extreme edge, I don't care which extreme edge, but an extreme edge so that she's not blocking traffic, then it wouldn't matter that she was caught up in her conversation.
Yeah.
So that she still is morally responsible in one sense, even if not in the sense of I can't maybe claim that, oh, she was particularly trying to block me and block traffic. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know me, so her action had nothing to do with me directly, but it did have to do with people, maybe. But you could say, well, no, because she was so caught up in her conversation, it didn't. But then I could still assign some blame because she allowed herself to be in a position where she allowed herself to forget.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually, that's exactly why my sort of read on the idea of ignorance here is that it's the higher bar, the sort of naturally higher bar for the involuntary. Like, if she had, let's say she had just had some kind of eye surgery and she couldn't see and she thought she was on a sidewalk or something, right? And then afterwards you're like, hey, you were in the middle of the road. And then she's like, oh, I'm so sorry.
I had no idea.
I thought I was on a sidewalk. I thought that was a dog, not a, you know, a,
right.
And then you're like,
and then that's not,
and then you're like,
okay,
that's totally, that was involuntary. I'm no longer mad at you at all, right?
Right.
That's the bar right there in the very particular circumstance. Like, she needs to genuinely not know. And then afterwards, once she does know, feel regret, right?
Now, this is not Aristotle, what I'm about to ask you. I'm asking for your honest opinion, because you may have noticed, I'm sure you have, because for people listening, Eric and I both teach young adults. We teach college courses. So we're dealing with people that are roughly 17 to 25 on a regular basis, right? In that age group, as we know through science, they're still developing, the brain is developing at least to the age of 24. And so, you know, they're still, and even Aristotle says that they're, that age group is working its way toward maturity, right? And so, of course, we have to treat them in certain ways. But one thing that, with a certain amount of latitude is what I'm saying. But I've noticed that it's very popular now in discussions on social media, which I don't usually involve myself in, but I do troll and read because I get curious, where you will see people saying that and making that exact claim. Like someone will say, oh, this person double parked. There's a good example, right? There's a Twitter account that's just about bad parking jobs, right? Where they take people submit photographs of bad parking jobs and how ridiculous it is. And you could see some really dumb bad parking jobs. And there will often be someone in the comment section saying something along the lines of, yeah, but you don't know what that person was going through. Maybe there was an emergency and they had to run into that Target because their kid was hurt in there. And they'll come up with these somewhat outlandish scenarios. They're not impossible scenarios, but they're somewhat outlandish. And right?
Because like that's what it takes to excuse it. Yeah.
Right. Now, what do you make of that as a kind of argument, a rhetorical strategy? Like should we
always be asking those what ifs, giving the benefit of the doubt?
That level of absurdity. I think we should always ask what ifs. I do think that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that we should ask the what ifs to the level of such absurdity of you know, you don't know. That person could have been running into Target because their child was a hostage in a holdup. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, well, I would have heard about that on the news. Yeah. So I know that that didn't happen, right? But you do see people making these kinds of absurd, extreme arguments.
Yes. Well, I think the more outlandish the benefit of the doubt is, then the less necessary it is, if that makes sense, or the less even reasonable it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my general kind of feeling about it. But yeah, I mean, even if it's an empty parking lot, then basically I think it's not a big deal if someone parks weird. But then if it's kind of a crowded parking lot and then the big truck comes and takes up two or three spots or something, then yeah, you know, I better get an outlandish excuse because otherwise I'm not giving you the benefit of the doubt.
That's funny. We're really getting into the weeds of particularity, but the truck thing doesn't bother me as much.
Oh, okay.
Like in this area, it's not trucks. It's buses that do it where they'll park, but they center themselves within three spaces. So the space that is in front of them and the space that is behind them is still fully open. Mm-hmm. They've just got it so that they're taking up three spaces, but they're legitimately taking up three spaces. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's the thing that bothers me, and this is a Larry David joke too, right? Is where someone will park for no good reason in between two spaces so that they're taking, and then you have a choice. Then it impacts your choice, right? It's a crowded parking lot. There aren't too many spaces. Let's say that the one to the left of the person is open. Because they've taken up two, the one on the left of the person is open, but now what do you do? Do you park fully in the left or do you park as close to the other person and then you're messing up the grid, right? That's the Larry David problem, right? I don't ever consider that a problem because I just park in the fully open space is. And if there's no parking, then I'm truly annoyed, of course. Because then now this person's carelessness creates a problem for you.
Yes.
You have to decide what you're going to do to balance it out or not.
We're constantly sort of calculating basically what level of hostility to have toward other people's bizarre actions.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so on the one hand, like I understand the impulse to come up with the sort of absurd scenario, hypothetical scenario that would excuse the action because we want to understand each other and be sympathetic to each other. But to a certain extent, there's almost a sort of facile relativism that shows up there, and I do mean facile. I don't think all relativism is bad, obviously, but this idea of I can come up through some mental gymnastics with some scenario that would excuse it, therefore it's excusable. That's the point that bothers me. Like if it's impressive you could come up with the mental gymnastic, I suppose. And if it turns out that that's the case, and that does, then yeah, I can agree that would excuse it. But the likelihood of that being the case is so extremely small that therefore everything becomes excusable. I could say, you know, that I could come up, I imagine, and Aristotle could come up, I imagine, with some kind of scenario that might, in some extreme ridiculous circumstance for Aristotle, excuse matricide. But it's so unlikely that it's still reasonable that Aristotle puts that in his category of things that you never
do. Yeah, and we can learn from Aristotle then, both in terms of the idea of whether something is truly involuntary or not. We can learn from that about how to handle benefit of the doubt, right? He says basically, if someone is sort of ignorant of a general principle, then it's probably not worth giving them the benefit of the doubt. And then if they are, if it's a particular circumstance where it makes sense, then it is. And the same thing goes from our standpoint as the judges of that. If we have a kind of general, obvious benefit of the doubt, like, oh yeah, that probably we're just doing this normal thing, then we give it. But if it's a really particular thing, and the more particular, the more absurd, right? If it's a really particular benefit of the doubt, then it becomes a little bit more like, okay, now we have to litigate this, you know?
Right. And in fact, that's kind of what Aristotle turns to next, because he says, you know, maybe since we're saying that there are ways in which people can be in error or can make a mistake through error, then we better examine how error arises. And he says it arises in, well, depends on how you read it, but I guess the total number of categories is 7, unless you think 2 of them are basically the same thing. So you can be ignorant of who is doing the action. He says that's pretty unlikely because we're mostly talking about situations in which you're doing the action. But you know, in certain really extreme moments of stress, you could have total disorientation, disassociation, where you're watching your own actions as though it's being done by someone else. Or you could imagine someone with multiple personalities, right? And where you could say, well, I'm even confused as to who did it. Mm-hmm. Was it me, or was it my alter ego Frank? You know, if that's the true condition. But he says that that's not likely to be a problem. But the rest can be sources of error. You could be in error about what you're doing, right? You're handing somebody, someone says they're thirsty, you hand them a drink that was handed to you thinking that it will quaff their thirst, and instead it's poison and it kills them. You didn't even know that's what you were doing, right? Mm-hmm. You could be in error about what it's in relation to. So he says, to do with what, right? That's how he puts it. So the first error is who did something. He says that doesn't come up much. Then there's what they did, right? The what, mm-hmm. what it is that you're doing. Then there's the to do with, what it has to do with. So I'm taking that to be in relation to. And then he says, in what circumstances. Now, we might read that, and the comma in this particular translation encourages us to read circumstance in relation to as being just two different ways of saying the same thing. Hmm. And they might be. But I can think of ways in which they might not be, right? So for instance, let's say that I'm handing someone money. Now, I'm doing that with a moral output. So in other words, it's money owed. But it's not owed by me, right? Let's say that it's not owed by me. But I know that it's owed by my wife, let's say, to this person. So I'm giving them the money. That would be a relation, right? I'm doing this. I know what I'm doing. I'm giving the person money. But the relation in this sense is that I'm paying a debt that's someone else's debt. So that's going through me. Whereas I could also see a circumstance that we're in a very dangerous part of town, for instance. And so handing this person the money in this part of town is stupid, the circumstances. So I might be making too fine of a distinction here, but I can at least imagine a way in which the relation to and circumstances aren't the same thing.
Oh, okay.
But
yeah.
It doesn't.
I read it more as a sort of the target of the thing, or the sort of goal of it.
Well, no, the goal hasn't come yet. The goal is the end. That's another
one. Oh yeah. For the sake of. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Right. So then he says there's also instruments, right? Mm-hmm. That I could be in error about instruments, that I think what I'm using is a reasonable instrument. So I'm doing the right thing. Let's say that I'm
the best way to get the best really way to get money from the ATM is with a hammer, obviously, right?
Right. I'm doing the right thing, but I'm doing it with the wrong instrument. I was thinking of something more quotidian, but yeah, okay. And then I could be in error about the end, the telos, the purpose of this thing, right? So my wife tells me I'm paying back a debt, but really I'm just giving this guy money because I don't know, she's playing a trick on me or something. So I'm giving him money in error because it's not for the reason that I thought it was. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, Hal, right? If I'm giving you back money that you lent me and I throw it at your feet, that's not the right way to do it, right? And that would be an error. But also, that's not really what he's talking about, though. What would be an example of Hal? Of an error in
Well, it's sort of like when you're knocking against someone, you know, on the street or whatever, and you think you're right to do so. The question is like, well, do you do it? Maybe you thought you were just giving them a gentle, like, you know, a gentle, like, hey, you're in the wrong spot. But then the way that you actually did it was you hit them pretty hard, right?
Yeah. Okay. I think you're right. That's probably what the how is, right? Like if I'm trying to, Like, let's imagine someone's about to be hit by a car and I'm trying to pull them out of the way. Mm. I have to gauge just how violent you know.
That's a better right. example, yeah.
No, actually, I think yours is the better example. Mine's just the more obvious one. All right, so we have these various ways in which we might go wrong, right? Mm-hmm. But that usually when it, and he says the most important ones, not surprisingly, are the what and the why, the telos, right? That I should know. What I'm doing. If I don't know what I'm doing, then that's sort of more excusable. Mm. If I think that I'm addressing the person who's dying of thirst, but it turns out I'm giving them poison, and I didn't know that. I didn't know what I was doing. Then, you know, how can you really find fault with me? But notice that here's a case of the involuntary that I'm bound to regret. Mm. Even if I can find no fault in myself, it's not non-voluntary, it's involuntary, mm-hmm. right? Because I'm sure to regret it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the idea being that once you kind of know, once you are no longer in ignorance, then it's, you know, that how you react to it is a kind of sign of your character.
Right. So now we finally get to the actual definition of the voluntary, which is as follows, at least in the Taylor translation. The voluntary would appear to be that of which the origin is in oneself, when one knows the particular circumstances of one's actions. So I know the how, the what, the why, and all that, and I've decided to do these things, then it's truly voluntary, simpliciter, right? Without qualification, that's what makes something voluntary. Hmm. But that doesn't end the chapter. There's another paragraph. And this paragraph is interesting and confusing to me. And we're running a little long considering we've only dealt with one chapter, and that's because of my diatribe against Forrest Gump. But we'll be somewhat summary here, in part because some of these issues are going to come back. But there are a couple things that I think are really fascinating about this chapter, and I have a feeling we're about to go longer than I'm hoping anyway. But that's okay. So here are the things. He says, all right, so it's now presumably it is not correct to say that things done from spirit or desire are involuntary. So he's getting into this idea of the composition of the soul, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this before, that according to Plato, and Aristotle sort of plays loose with this. He says in some ways it's useful to think this way, and in some ways it's not. So he doesn't think of it as something that is definitely true about the soul. It's something that is one way of understanding the soul, but a useful way of understanding it. And that's the tripartite soul, mm-hmm. that we have the nutritive soul, the appetitive soul, and the rational soul, right? And so when he's saying things that are coming from spirit or desire, he's basically talking about mostly the appetite of soul, right? Mm. And so in other words, we're kind of back to the thing he's already addressed, which is the external things that are pleasurable. Like, can I say that it's truly a voluntary action if I'm saying I'm an alcoholic and someone put whiskey in front of me and I drank it, is that voluntary or involuntary?
If something comes from your base instincts, do we say it's voluntary? Yeah.
Right. And here's where he says exactly what you were talking about earlier about voluntary applying to animals and children. He says, first of all, in that case, no other animals or children would act voluntarily because they apparently don't act from reason, right? They are immature or not capable of rationality in the case of animals, according to Aristotle. And therefore, and yet we still say that, you know, We still scold the dog for, I don't know, eating food off the table, because we still reckon that it's voluntary, even if it didn't come from rational choice. So that's his first objection. And then he says, so then is it the case that we do voluntarily none of the things we do from desire and spirit? He says, surely that's ridiculous, in part because of the thing that he's already talked about in the discussion we've already had. But then he adds something else that I think is kind of interesting. He says, further, how do cases where we go wrong in calculation differ in respect from being involuntary from those where we go wrong through spirit? Both are to be avoided, and the non-rational feelings appear to be no less proper to humans. So the actions from spirit and desire are no less human actions. So it's absurd to class them as involuntary. And even though he doesn't intend this to be an inquiry into this part of human nature, I do find that aside pretty interesting, right? Mm-hmm. That the non-rational feelings appear to be no less proper to humans. And this is an interesting argument that you can imagine someone saying, well, okay, in fact, it almost seemed at times like he was flirting with us, right? That the truly human is the rational. I mean, he does. That's our specific difference, is the rational. And so you can imagine someone reading Aristotle and feeling somewhat justified in saying, okay, so that means that we have an animal nature, which is our spirit, but that's not the truly human. It still impacts us, but it's not the truly human. Mm-hmm. The truly human is the rational. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying that even though we share spirit and the appetite of soul with animals and with children, and it's non-rational, that doesn't make it not truly human. That now, how I'm reading this is that, remember that the desiring part of our soul, according to Aristotle, in book one and book two, he said that the desiring part of our soul is open to reason. It's open to being led by reason. Mm-hmm. It's not itself rational. You and I tried to make the case that it is, to some extent, pre-rational, and I still believe that, pre-cognitive, pre-rational, that the emotions and the appetites, but the emotions, which are part of that desiring soul, mm-hmm. that they are alerting us to things that are cognitive, that are alerting us to the way it is in the world, and that that becomes the basis for rational decision. But he's saying that they're not strictly speaking rational, of course. But notice that to me, that's the linchpin, is that the reason that this is still they're fully human, they're fully proper to humans.
Yes, absolutely. And
is because they are conditionable by reason, right?
Yep. Yeah. There's this part of the desiring soul that listens to reason. That's the sort of go-between our kind of instinctual part of ourselves and our rational part of ourselves.
Right. And so we might use the excuse of, well, I've always been a thief and so therefore my thievery is involuntary. But your choice to allow yourself to always be a thief was not involuntary, right? And so it's absurd to claim that your thieving is involuntary on that basis.
Yeah, and then I guess his sort of baseline then is saying, well, we should just assume that it's voluntary, basically. Things that we often will claim are involuntary, let's just assume they're voluntary and then try to target exactly what something might not be or is voluntary. Yeah.
Right. And so that means that we now have to go into a careful examination of choice, which is what he does in the next chapter, right? That if we're saying that choice can be involved in different levels, that you can make the choice to allow yourself to be in a state of error by getting drunk, or you can make a choice to not curb your various desires and emotions and therefore act out of irascibility and anger or out of lust or greed or whatever else, that even though you might somewhat be willing to say, well, when I was in the throes of anger, I didn't consciously choose to punch someone, it just sort of flowed out of the anger, but you chose to allow yourself to be someone that gets into those states of extreme anger, mm-hmm. right? Because in this case, we're not talking about the situation where someone has overstrained human nature, right? The idea is that for Aristotle, while there may be certain situations that overstrain human nature that will drive anyone mad with anger, that for the most part, people who are irascible have allowed themselves to be irascible. And so then we have to examine what that means. What is it to make a choice? And that's what he'll do next. But obviously, given that we are now an hour and 40 into this discussion, we're not doing that today. So this is where, unless you have, do you have anything that's, is there anything that
I think that's not a, that was a good choice.
A good choice of a place to end. Yeah. And to examine how choice operates, that will be the remit of what we do next time.